This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Later in the show, we'll have a look at how Cincinnati is becoming bourbonized. First up,
you give me fever when you kiss me, fever when you hold me tight, fever in the morning.
Little Willie John with the song Fever, recorded at King Records. The Cincinnati Playhouse in the Park will salute the legacy of King Records with a celebration in Washington Park on Sunday. Celebrating King Records will feature an evening of food, music, and memories, capped with a staged concert reading of K.J. Sanchez's play Cincinnati King. The event launches the OTR Perform series and is also included as part of this year's Cincinnati Fringe Festival. And here to talk about the event and King Records are K.J. Sanchez, Playhouse in the Park director and associate artist, Philip Paul, who was a studio drummer at King Records from 1951 until 1964, and Chris Shadler, an urban planner with the Xavier University Community Building Institute and the project manager for King Studios. And you can join the conversation today at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Chris, KJ, and Philip, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
KJ, there's an interesting story behind the little Willie John song, Fever, that we just heard, isn't there? I mean, he was actually the first to record it, right?
That's right, he was. Now, I'm a bit of an interloper to this story. I've only been researching and studying and falling in love with the stories around King Records for the last 4 years. So I'm a little shy and very honored to be with these gentlemen, in particular, Mr. Philip Paul, who played on that tune that we just heard, Fever. But that was my hook and my entrance, I guess, into the story. Is it's a song that everyone knows. I live in Jersey. I grew up in New Mexico. I could say arguably almost everybody in our country has heard that song. I didn't know until I started working on it that it all began with that first version sung by Little Willie, drums played by Mr. Paul, recorded at King Studios. And of course, that song has been recorded, covered by Beyonce, Madonna, even Michael Bublé.
Yeah, Peggy Lee's done it. Nancy Sinatra has done it. So it has been covered by a lot of people. And Philip, you were actually the drummer on that, right?
Right.
Yeah. What was that like doing that recording?
Well, not celebrated like it is now. It was just another session to us. We were trying to, of course, accompany Little Willie John, but we were having fun doing that also. And I like to mention, I remember when Peggy Lee covered Little Willie John's Fever. A newspaper man from somewhere called me and said he wanted to know how I felt about Peggy Lee covering this tune. So I said, how do I feel? She did a great job. And I said, we did that all the time at King Records. We would hear something and then we'd cover it that very same day. So that's a common in the recording business, to cover a tune that's going to sound good or look like it's going to sell. So everyone does that.
Philip, what were the recording sessions like? Were they? Did you just go in and start playing and see where it went, or were these more rigid, and was there a process to how it all went?
It was different with every artist. Like some artists would come in with their music and wanted to play it a certain way, and then some artists like Freddie King would come in and he would sit over in the corner and start playing a tune that he's going to record. Of course, we didn't know that, but he was just playing around and he said, come on, join in. So I might start playing a rhythm, or the bass player might play something, and it started sounding good. Freddie King would say, that's great, let's record it right now.
And you were telling me that Little Willie John was one of the artists that always came in totally prepared, knew exactly what he was doing, sort of a Frank Sinatra,
right?
Just like knew his material really, really well.
Very talented man. Angry, but talented.
And very organized.
Yeah.
Yeah, and tragically died penniless in prison at the age of 30.
Hmm.
I think he had a it was something about his size, you know. He was a small man like myself, and he liked to kid a lot, and then they would grab him and rough him around, and he didn't like that. So he had a persona of being a bad guy, but he wasn't really.
Chris, tell us about some of the history of King Records. It started by Sid Nathan back in the 1940s, and what lasted for about three decades, was it?
Sounds about right.
Yeah.
You know, it started here in Cincinnati. Sid was a record store owner. Then he wanted to start putting out bluegrass records and eventually put out R&B records, and it went into the 70s.
Mm-hmm. And didn't he fail at one point? Didn't he fail and start over? Is that what?
It was really ebb and flow. I interviewed his nephew, Steve Halper, who lives here in Cincinnati, and he remembers that there were times, there were flush times and good times, and then there were times when Uncle Sid was very, very stressed out and that they were very near bankruptcy. You know, so much of, especially in the 40s, early 50s, there was a lot of invention happening. Like, nobody really knew how to do this. Records, first, I guess, there were singles that were cut, and then even the notion of an album coming out was a pretty inventive new thing for the early 60s. And Sid was doing it on his own, you know, eighth grade education, didn't know anything about the record industry, as Chris said, and just sort of made his way. You have to have quite an ego to accomplish all of that.
I can see it now. He had to have that ego because he had to portray a person as knowing what they were doing, and he didn't. He depended a lot on the musicians that he hired. And sometimes he would leave us alone to develop the tune, and sometimes he would get involved until he'd come down out of the studio and tell you how to play. But I believe that was a mind game he was playing. It wasn't a situation where he knew what he was going to do, what he was doing, and he was trying to help you. You had to help yourself.
You know, I do that sometimes as a director. If we're in rehearsal and something's not quite going right, I have no way to fix it. But I say, okay, hold. I know how to fix this. And I always know that between the time when I stand up and walk towards the stage, something will happen. Either I'll have an idea, but usually the actors go, oh, right. Yeah, we know what to do now. We know how to fix it. Right. But yeah, there's a lot of that like facade, pretending you know what you're doing.
There were times when all the musicians said, we were all arguing. We were fighting with one another because I think that's the kind of atmosphere he wanted to get that energy out of us.
So tell me a little bit more about what it was like working for Sid Nathan.
Hard, very hard. He wanted, we could record three LPs a day. He wanted something different on every tune, and that's almost impossible. But we had to psych Sid too. I remember when we were doing the twist, and Sid didn't like the beat I was playing, and he came down out of the studio and grabbed my drumsticks and attempting to show me what I should play, you know. And I heard that he was kind of a half drummer, and I told him I don't like people to grab my drumsticks. So, you know, that's my living, and I don't like that.
Yeah, those are my tools. Don't yeah. mess with those. Yeah.
So I snatched them back out of his hand, and he said, okay, and he went back up into the booth, and he said, all right, let's try it again. And he tried it again. I played the very same beat that I was playing in the beginning. He said, that's it. So he was trying to play a mind game with me. That's all he wanted to do. He wasn't really trying to tell me what to play. He was trying to get me angry enough where I put some more energy into what I was doing.
Chris, tell us about the King Studios at Xavier. That's a new project, isn't it?
It started around 2008. Okay. Essentially, it was started through the neighborhood of Evanston, where King Records was, right. 1540 Brewster. The neighborhood wanted to commemorate King Records. A lot of people have for a long time. And the project essentially is there to bring King Records out of obscurity and into the spotlight where it belongs. King Records should be a household name. It has that kind of legacy. And so it's, you know, I see it kind of as a gathering point for as many people as possible who are passionate about King to get together and try to commemorate that legacy.
And you're not really a record label, so to speak, but you're trying to accomplish certain things. It's all part of experiential learning for the students, isn't it?
Essentially, that's one part of it. Another part is, again, awareness, doing things like this interview, letting people know that King is out there. You'd be surprised how many people have, you know, they're in Cincinnati. You have this great legacy. Nobody knows anything about it. There was an event that took place at 1540 Brewster a couple years ago. We were walking down there. Somebody on Brewster who lived there said, "What are you guys doing?" So we're going down to 1540 Brewster where James Brown recorded. And he's like, "James Brown recorded down there? I didn't know that." You know, guy right up the street. So there's a lot of work to be done. This is an important story for Cincinnati for many, many reasons. It's a completely unique story. It's separate from Motown and Stax. It has its own individual appeal, and that's what we're trying to do, is get that word out there.
I think it also has the potential to be so inspiring to young artists today, young musicians, not only to understand the level of musicianship and skill that you would have to have, like Mr. Paul had playing on those tunes, but also the do-it-yourself chutzpah that King Records was all about, right? It was an independent label. They didn't want to play by the rules of the big guys. And musicians today, you know, can get squashed or never even get access and never get an audience because the record industry is run by corporations now. But you see that there are all these new ways to distribute your music today. And I think that King Records and King Studio in particular can really shine a light for us.
There was a great quote from Larry Nager, he said, "King Records was as important to Cincinnati as the Ohio River." I always loved that when he said that, and I didn't fully understand what it meant till I kept working on this project and working with Mr. Paul. And that's that there's three big components of diversity here. One of them is the business model, this DIY ethos. The other one is cultural, where you had African-American musicians and white musicians coming together and playing together. You had the business, where you had the same thing, complete diversity in an era when that was almost unheard of in the workplace. So it's just this great story in a time where there's obviously still racial tensions in America, and you've got this awesome story that came right out of Cincinnati.
Yeah. Who were some of the other big names that recorded at King?
Oh, man, there's tons.
So many.
You want to use the front door for everybody. The household name is James Brown, but then it just goes deep after that.
Freddie King, of course, yep. Bonnie Lou. Yep.
Mr. Paul. Trini Lopez recorded at King. I was on that session. And when I mentioned that to a lot of people, I said, "Who's Trini Lopez?" And then other people remember him. He was a big star, Las Vegas star, and he recorded at King.
Tiny Bradshaw,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
A young man named Ike Turner.
Ole Miss Jackson.
Freddie King.
Mm-hmm. Cowboy Copas.
Yeah,
Mulligan. Stanley Brothers. Otis, Grandpa Jones.
Grandpa Jones. Yeah. A lot of people don't. Yeah. Yeah. Otis Williams, I believe.
Right.
Otis Williams and his Charms.
Yeah. So it was what, KJ? Hundreds and hundreds of artists?
Absolutely. Hundreds of artists. Country, R&B, gospel, bluegrass, jazz. And all of the prototype of rock and roll is right there.
Yeah, I mean, another big story that I've been passionate about that has moved me is that, you know, there's two things that make this, the King story, very interesting. And one is that there's no doubt that it is the birthplace of funk. That's undeniable. But the other is that Cincinnati, and through King Records, is an origin of rock and roll music, even before Memphis. So that is a huge cultural asset that this city has not taken advantage of. I mean, if you think about that, that should be on billboards everywhere.
Absolutely.
People would come here for that, but it just hasn't been taken advantage of at all.
So. And not to mention the influence in pop music in general. We didn't mention yet Hank Ballard, right, and the original Twist, which Mr. Paul played on.
I did all of Hank Ballard's. Every tune he recorded at King, I did it.
What was it like being part of that original Twist?
Oh, I told you some of it with the conflict I had with Mr. Nathan. God bless him.
Did you enjoy, but ultimately, did you enjoy being part of that?
Oh, I loved it. I loved it. And the thing about playing with those groups, after they became well known, they had a hit record, they would want you to go out on the road with them. You know, Hank Ballard wanted me to join his band. I said, no, thank you. You know, my job is in the studio. I don't travel with the people that I record with.
So you never took anybody up on any of those offers?
No.
And if you think about the twist and the drum beat that Mr. Paul put down, it changed the way people dance. I mean, you're looking at the guy who made people move their bodies differently in social scenarios, so that's pretty big.
And do you know the story of how the twist ended up, how Chubby Checker ended up being the household name associated with the twist? Mr. Paul, you want to tell this one?
Yeah. Oh, Hank Ballard was supposed to appear at this event in Philadelphia, and they couldn't find Hank Ballard. He was, they say he was off in Atlanta with some woman. So he missed his big opportunity, and they went and got Chubby Checker, and that's how the twist became Chubby Checker.
The rest is history.
Dick Clark found, his name was Ernest Evans, and Clark had him lip sync to the tune on air on television, and then took Ernest Evans into the recording studio and re-recorded note for note exactly what Ballard and the band played.
Now, KJ, your play is Cincinnati King, and I think you've described this as a theatrical album. Explain why you call it that.
It's an invented term, I suppose. I make documentary plays and have been making documentary plays for many years about a lot of different subjects. And with this, I wanted to change the form a little bit. And so it's a documentary play in that the actors are playing the people that I interviewed and also some of the folks that I have listened to in recordings and interviews by other writers. But it's interspersed with some of the tunes from the King catalog. So it's almost a jukebox musical and a documentary play all mashed up together.
And how did you conduct the research for this? I mean, that was a lot of work, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it's only just begun. I mean, I am not the expert on King Records in any way, and that's why I love making plays this way, is I come into something that I don't know anything about, and then I cast my net as wide as possible and rely on the generosity of people to tell me their own personal stories, and then I just start reading as much as I can, listening to as much as I can, and just totally fell in love with it.
Well, what was the process like? I mean, you had a bunch of volunteers and a bunch of different people who were actually going out in the community.
Yeah, volunteers, some students from CCM. They all went into the community and conducted interviews, and then I had a pile of those interviews. And it's a viral process. You know, you gain one person's trust, and then they introduce you to somebody else, and they introduce you to someone else. And so the great thing about this day on Sunday is that the folks who come to see it, we're going to have a sign-up list, and if anyone else wants to grant me an interview after that, I want to continue the research after this event on Sunday.
And as you've been doing all this research on the history of King Records, as you go along, you realize that there's just so much more to this story than you ever thought.
There is, and I'm hoping that this just inspires other writers to make more shows. Like, there needs to be a musical about Little Willie John entirely. And I think that theater is the best way to cover it, because films have to, you know, forgive me for saying, but they have to dumb down the subject a little bit. But with a play, you can keep things more complicated. You can have a character like Sid that's so multifaceted and complicated, and you don't have to make him a simple bad guy or a good guy, you know?
Yeah, and Chris, King was this whole studio was innovative. I mean, it was a one-stop shop, wasn't it? I mean, you could go in and you could record your music there and just take it through all the steps you needed to get it out into the market, couldn't you? Which was unusual for the time.
Exactly. I mean, it was a DIY outfit, and that was a good business model. That's what helped keep his head above water and see more of that green, and keep making music. And that drive also is what helped. Is part of that origin of these different types of music that were created, because you had all these different players coming together that normally in other circumstances wouldn't be playing together. So it's that DIY ethos, he didn't know what he was doing, but he had the passion and the drive, and he kept cracking the whip and trying new things, and he succeeded.
Sid, was he pretty innovative? I mean, is that how you viewed Sid?
As innovative? I wouldn't say so, but I mean, He depended on the musicians and the A&R men to come up with ideas and tunes that he felt would affect the American people. He would sit in the booth, and if he could pat his foot to what we were playing, if he felt good about it, he went with that. And that's, it was heartfelt or mind felt.
I wonder if his greatest talent was he knew an opportunity when he saw one.
Exactly. He was an opportunist.
So you don't think he would have turned down Elvis or the Beatles, or if they'd come to him?
I found out from his nephew that he, in fact, did turn down the Beatles.
Did he really?
They sent him a demo tape, and he was like, what is this? I don't get it.
He almost turned down James Brown.
James Brown, right? Didn't get...
Yeah, he didn't get please, 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 and he was screaming, what is this? He just says the same word over and over again.
I can't say the word he said.
So, KJ, when people come to this reading Sunday, what exactly can they expect? I mean, how's this going to be
performed?
Well,
the whole afternoon and evening is a pretty great event. It's going to start at 5 o'clock with children's activities. We're going to have a musical instrument petting zoo, and what that means is that kids can come up and play instruments, and we're going to just, like, encourage kids to make music. And then from 5:30 to 6:30, Philip Hall and his quartet are going to play. This is going to be awesome. My husband's a drummer and my brother-in-law's a musician, and they're both excited about coming because it's going to be like a master workshop on how Mr. Paul made this music. He's going to talk about the Tiny Bradshaw tune, Soft and Heavy Juice.
We're going to play some Tiny Bradshaw tunes. And I don't think that's ever been done before. I think nowhere in the country have I heard anyone play Tiny Bradshaw tunes. And we rehearsed and we did some research, and we hope we can do a good job at it. Mm-hmm.
And then we'll follow up. The final event will be the play. It'll be a concert reading, 9 actors playing all these characters with a band, music and performance. And we also have booths. King Studios will have a booth, so you can get more information about them and learn how to support them. Mr. Paul will be selling albums. King Studio will be selling these awesome t-shirts, one of which Chris is wearing right now. They're really cool. So lots of good stuff for the whole afternoon and evening,
so
starting
at
5.
What do you hope people will take away from Cincinnati King? What do you hope they get out of it?
Pride in their city, interest in participating, getting involved in helping King Studios move forward, and inspiration to make music like King Records again.
Okay, and give us the information. It's Sunday afternoon. How long is it?
Sunday afternoon from 5 to 9.
Okay.
At Washington Park. This is kicking off the OTR Presents series for the summer. It's part of the Fringe Festival. It's being produced by Cincinnati Playhouse in the Park. There are going to be food trucks and a beer garden, and it's going to be a great time. And people should bring their own chairs and blankets, spread out on the lawn, and have a great evening. And it's all, and the music, all the performances are free.
And Philip Paul's going to be playing with his group, which is just going to be awesome. Philip,
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. KJ, Chris, thanks to everybody for being here this afternoon. KJ Sanchez, Playhouse in the Park director and associate artist. Philip Paul, who was studio drummer at King Records from 1951 to 1964. And Chris Shadler, an urban planner with the Xavier University Community Building Institute and the project manager for King Records. Coming up on Cincinnati Edition, all things bourbon and how one of Kentucky's best-known contributions is spreading into Cincinnati. Thanks to Sharon Reitz for listening to 91.7 WVXU today.